The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm Director of Author Events, and I am pleased to welcome our guest. You've heard of the Jameses, Henry, William, and Alice. You know the Kennedys, John, Robert, and Edward. Now it's time to meet the Emanuels, a family whose son's achievement will make every Jewish mother green with shpilchus. Ah, that's the right audience. I'm sure you're already familiar with two of the sons of Benjamin Emanuel and Marcia Emanuel. Rahm, the Chicago mayor and former White House chief of staff, and Ari, a Hollywood talent agent, CEO of William Morris Endeavor, and inspiration for the character Ari Gold, played by Jeremy Piven on the hit show Entourage. Today, we welcome Ezekiel, the eldest brother of the clan. He's a vice provost and university professor at the University of Pennsylvania and a member of the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences. Emanuel also served as the special advisor for health policy to President Obama's Director of the Office of Management and Budget, and in his spare time, he's an op-ed columnist for the New York Times. He's here today to tell us about his remarkable family and how they moved from Russia to Palestine to Chicago and into the public conscious. Please welcome Zeke Emanuel.
It's a great pleasure to be here and join the august list of people who come and speak at the Free Library. It's just an amazing list, and it's an honor to be included among them. So I'm going to begin with my father's story. He was born in Jerusalem when it was still under British rule. A few short years later, his elder brother, he only had one, ended up being on the side of a skirmish between some Arabs and Jews, and he got hit by a ricocheting bullet off the ground, and it glanced his knee. But unfortunately, in the pre-penicillin and antibiotic era, he ended up dying of infection. My father was left as an only child to parents who really mourned seriously the loss of their son. My father was as a consequence, I think because of his brother's shadow, not a particularly good student. He was, in fact, an average or mediocre student and mostly known as a joker in class. In 1946, he left Israel, or left Palestine at that point, and went to Switzerland to study medicine. Pretty remarkable in that he arrived in Switzerland knowing English and Hebrew, but no French, and he was in the French part of Switzerland. And in about 6 weeks, taught himself French by looking at the Reader's Digest and translating between English and French. And a few weeks after that, he actually took the final exams for the first year. He arrived about three-quarters of the way through the first year and passed. He ended up graduating number two in his class and then came to the United States to Cincinnati, where they have a tremendous children's hospital, and was studying there to become a pediatrician as an intern and resident. And in Cincinnati, he made two big mistakes. Mistake number one is that coming from Europe, having no experience in the United States, this is 1953, just keep that in mind, he began dating a black woman. Now, you don't do that in Cincinnati in 1953. In fact, the head of the hospital called him in and told him that he had to break off that relationship. And my dad actually met her because her brother worked in the hospital and he liked going to jazz presentations. The second big mistake is actually pivotal to our family and the fact that my mother and father met. He was asked by a plastic surgeon to change the bandages on this woman, who the plastic surgeon has just given a nose job to. Turned out she was stunningly beautiful. And my father didn't change the bandage once a day, but three times a day. His attentions on this woman got him in trouble. It turned out that she was the girlfriend of the mob leader who was lived in Covington, Kentucky. And one day, a couple of guys pulled up in a Buick Roadster and had bulges under their coat. And when they asked the information officer at the hospital where Dr. Emanuel was, she was smart enough to realize this was trouble. She called up to the chief resident. The chief resident found my father, whisked him into his car, drove him to the train station, stuffed a few dollars in his pocket, and then sent him with a ticket to Canada. Unfortunately, my father was, at that time, a British subject and didn't have his passport. And here he is going north towards Canada, knowing nobody, nothing, with a few dollars in his pocket. But my father is one of these people who sits down at a table in a restaurant and within 5 minutes is talking to the table next door and within 10 minutes already has an invitation for dinner. And he got into a conversation with some other people and they put him up for 2 weeks in their home in Rochester. He tried twice to cross the border and never made it. After 2 weeks, he made his way back down to Cincinnati and got his stuff. He was still a wanted man. Got his stuff and left to Chicago, to the Mount Sinai Hospital in Chicago. And there one day, not long after he arrived, he had to take a baby down to the X-ray department because the attending thought that the baby had intussusception. My dad did not think so. The radiology technician said that, well, she could had time to take the X-ray development and let him know. He laid down on the gurney, and about 45 minutes later, she finished with the X-ray, came out to show him the films. He was dead asleep on the gurney because at that time he was working every other night on call, and basically they were constantly completely dead tired. She released the wheel lock on the gurney, and it slid out the emergency room opening onto the cold night air. This was the end of October, and my dad, you know, got startled awake when he hit the cold air. He thought this was pretty funny, he walked in, saw that he was right, the baby didn't have intussusception, and began dating my mom. And within a few weeks, they were engaged to be married. A few years later, they went to Israel. My father returned, and I was born there. My dad did not have a great success at getting a good job. That was a time when there were too many doctors and not enough work for them. So after 2 years, they came back to the United States, came back to Chicago, and the idea was that my dad would become a specialist in kidney diseases of children, learn how to dialyze, which has just become available in the United States, and then go back to Israel. They eventually had Ram, they had Ari, time passed. He never got the right job. We went to Jewish day school, lived in the city. My mother was very active in the civil rights movement way before it had become popular. I mean, I'm talking about 1961. She participated in the 1963 March on Washington and came back in Chicago and was a leader in the core Congress on Racial Equality movement. And I vividly remember her taking us to demonstrations, but also a bunch of people, blacks and whites at our house, practicing civil disobedience and making their bodies limp so that it would be difficult for the police to arrest them and put them into paddy wagons. This was a great inspiration to young boys who, of course, liked to practice making themselves limp and making it difficult for their brothers to lift them up. But we were a very close-knit and very, very rambunctious group. And my mother had, I would say, instilled in us this tremendous need and importance for doing good for others. We were not very rich at the time, and we, nonetheless, she always thought that the most important thing was to help out other people in the community. For example, and she did this both through the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, but also individually, we had a lovely house cleaner named Vern Henry, who used to come over to the house. She was about 4'10", frequently had cotton in her ears for ear infection and toothpicks sticking out. And we all just loved her. she would, the most important thing that she did was she taught us how to iron. We love the fact she set up this iron, and even at a young age, she entrusted us to iron and press the steam button, and it was a fantastic thing. But my mom just didn't think Vern should be a house cleaner, so she enrolled her in community college to become a nurse and an LPN, and she made sure that Vern had a path up. And this was typical of my mother, always taking care of other people, taking us to demonstrations, making sure we knew what the right thing was. And I think one of the big things that she did while we were growing up is to emphasize that, you know, you don't care about what other people say. You figure out what the right thing to do is, and you stick to it, and you defend it vigorously. It's probably that teaching that educated us about how to not be pacifists. My mom always claimed she was a pacifist. None of us really believed it. But she wouldn't allow any guns in the house, not even squirt guns on hot summer days in Chicago. She, of course, could not prevent this, and her boys were boys, after all. But we also were fierce defenders of what we thought was right. We grew up in a part of Chicago, which at that time was heavily populated by immigrants, but also heavily populated by people who had just come from the Kentucky coal fields in Appalachia to Chicago, who were derisively called hillbillies. And we faced, as we were growing up, a lot of prejudice. It wasn't infrequent that we were called kikes, but much more frequent that we were called nigger lovers because we were the only family in the community that had a lot of blacks who came over. We played with them out on the street. And when we, in the summers, went to the beach and would hang out at the beach, the Foster Avenue Beach, Ram and Ari in about 3 days became incredibly dark. They just had my mom's skin, and it wasn't not uncommon for them to be called niggers and be told that this beach was not open to them. We had to defend ourselves, and we were not big kids. As I point out, Ram, in fact, was a pretty small kid, but we were pretty tough kids. And this is where my mom's philosophy, even if the philosophy of fighting was not her view, but of standing up to bullies and not being pushed around for things which you thought were right. And so we very frequently just stood up and defended what we thought was important and what we thought were the right principles. It wasn't, as I say, infrequent as kids that we got into a lot of scrapes. And the important thing is my mom never, never scolded us for that. As a matter of fact, one of the episodes I relate in the book is about my gym teacher at our Jewish day school, Mr. Kerr. Mr. Kerr was a veteran and had a crew cut and walked around with khaki pants and a white T-shirt. And one day, you know, you can imagine, poor guy. He's a gym teacher at a Jewish day school, not known for its physical prowess, mostly known for their big mouths and smart aleck views. And we were, who knows what, going all over the place, chaos, not very much order, not being synchronized in whatever we were supposed to be doing. And he got really upset, and he just screamed, "Line up!" And he then gave us this little spiel about the fact that, you know, we had to be respectful, and we had to call him sir, and if you didn't think you had to be respectful and call him sir, you could get out of line and make your point. Well, me being raised by my mother and father, I stood forward. And, you know, he looked around and was a little surprised, trying to intimidate us. And he said, you know, "Are you out of line on purpose?" And I said, "I don't think we should have to call you sir. It's sir is a title of respect, and it has to be earned, and you just can't command it." Yeah, next stop, Morton Reisman, the principal's office. And, you know, 20 minutes later, Mom walks into the office, says hi to me, tries to find out what my position is, goes in, and, you know, true to her form, she defended me. And she defended the fact that I was right, that, you know, sir was a term that had to be earned and couldn't be commanded. And this was very characteristic of my mother. over a long period of time, she was in the principal's office, if not daily, every other day, with my brother Ari. Ari is a physically fearsome kid. He had to be, because when he was born, he was brought home, and his crib formed an L with the bunk bed that Ram and I had. We used to jump from Ram's bed, which was the top bunk, into the crib to see how high the baby could go. Ari survived this, and he thrived. And if we never back down from a fight, Ari provokes fights and certainly never back down at all. One, I think, quite characteristic and memorable story is we had a friend when we moved to Wilmette that was a little funny looking and had glasses at that time as a young kid and didn't speak clearly. And he frequently, as you know, kids will do, got made fun of. And Ari was his defender. And once one of the big alpha males in school was making fun of this other kid, and Ari walked past him in the school cafeteria, and the kid said something. Ari went over, took his tray, and whapped it up, and they got into a fight, and my mother was back in the principal's office. But she was defended the fact that this kid was not behaving properly, and Ari was defending the kid who was being unfairly attacked. Ari, as you all know, had very, very severe dyslexia. I'm sure the dyslexia somehow, we've never traced the genetics, but it came from my mom because she is a voracious reader but a terrible speller. And one form of dyslexia is being quite bad speller. Both Ram and I are like atrocious spellers. We used to, you know, get out in the first round of spelling bees at school, much to our chagrin. I hated those things. But Ari got the full-blown version in that he couldn't read. And he was this kind of kid who, you know, people said was lazy, he wasn't paying attention. He certainly was hyperactive, but he was anything but lazy. Ari was completely, totally full of energy, and he worked his tail off no matter what he did. It was just that he had this dyslexia and ADHD in an era before they really had those labels, before people recognized the problem. This is the mid-60s. Lots of people had sort of, you might say, given up on him. Not my mom. She would never give up on him. She fiercely worked with him. She developed this technique of putting flour in a tray and having him trace out letters so he could physically feel them as well as see them. When he got to high school, there was a special ed person, and my mom made sure he got special attention with a woman we call Gibby, who was a fierce defender and educator of Ari. And when the schools thought that he should go into the vocational track because he would never make it to college, again, she refused to give up on him. And in fact, he ended up going to a good college and, as you all know, succeeding much better than either of his brothers. My mother, my father, you know, had this American dream thing. He came as an immigrant from overseas. He came with $25 in his pocket and a very, very special Parker pen. And he bought into the American dream like all immigrants do, and he needed to succeed. And for him, like for many Americans, success in the 1960s was a house in the suburbs and two cars in the garage. We were city kids. My mom was heavily involved in the politics of the city, civil rights, school integration. But my father needed his house in the suburbs. And one day in 1968, he announced he had bought a house in the suburbs, in the North Shore of Chicago. My mom, you know, when he announced this, said, "Why didn't you buy two?" It was not a good time for her. All her political activities, the idea that she might actually run for office in Chicago, went up in smoke when we moved to Wilmette. Now, we as kids on the one hand, didn't like moving because you had to be dependent upon your mom for being shuttled around. There was no public transportation. On the other hand, we enormously benefited from fantastic public schools, and I believe the best public high school in the country, Nutria West, where I had just a huge number of fantastic teachers and fantastic peers, really some of the smartest people I've ever met as classmates. But my mom, her civil rights activities frustrated, her political hopes frustrated. Well, she didn't let that get to her. Of course, being resilient, she figured out how to transmute her interests in the suburbs. And one of the things she learned is that just a few houses down from us, on the street we lived, was one of the big slumlords of Chicago. Never allowing an opportunity to go, she decided that rather than picket the houses in the slums, why don't you just picket the slumlord at his house? And yes, who, right? You can imagine this did not go over well with our neighbor. And he was not happy, and he kept threatening and calling the police. But my mom, being pretty smart, figured out they were all within the law. They were on public property. They stayed on the sidewalk. They never went into his land. And about 4 months later, he moved. A key aspect of our growing up was the fact that we spent summers in Israel. My father and mother had this hope of, certainly through the early 60s, of moving back to Israel, of my father getting a job worthy of him. One never ended up coming. But we did go to Jewish day school, so we would learn Hebrew. We'd be ready when we moved back. And then the 1967 war came. I remember the morning because I got up early before my brothers, opened the bedroom door, and there was a glow coming from the family room, which there never was. I walked out into the hall and saw at the end of the hall my parents on their knees in front of our black and white TV with the sound very, very low, looking at it. It was the start of the Six-Day War in Israel. The house, the whole school was tense, and we were all on eggshells during that time. Just after the war ended, my parents decided that while other Jews were donating to Israel, they would send their kids. My mom and her three rambunctious kids, age 9, 7, and 6, about 2 weeks at the after the war ended, headed for Israel. My aunt on my mother's side lived in Tel Aviv. She arrived when I was born and never left. We moved into her apartment, which was in Israel, it's called a 1.5-room apartment. Basically, it was a living room, cum kitchen, cum dining room, and a small alcove off it. Couldn't have been more than 350 square feet. Just imagine two relatively large women, three rambunctious kids, and two dogs in that space. Yeah, insanity. But Israel was heaven for us boys. It was warm. It was entirely safe. My aunt had her apartment just two blocks from the beach. Every morning about 6 a.m., we would go with her, blanket, bag stuffed with fruits and vegetables, and take the dogs down to the beach and walk them. She would go back to the apartment. She was a tutor of the English language to various Israelis. She would go back, and we would stay on the beach, and we would swim. We would make sandcastles. Basically, it was the three of us hanging out. We made friends with the lifeguards who would take us on their big flatboats called hassakas out. They would use the boats for rescuing or just patrolling the beach, and we would learn how to paddle those enormous boats. But we spent hours and hours, day in and day out, just the three of us playing around. And I think that was a pivotal moment, probably the key to all of us staying so close together. It was really just the three of us. We had grown up in the same bedroom, and in Israel, for summer after summer, we slept and played together. And so when people ask, how often do you talk to your brothers? Are you close to the your brothers? It's like, I don't understand the question. I talk to them 3 or 4 times a week. We're constantly giving each other ideas, books to read, places to go. And I wouldn't know what to do without them. They're my closest friends. They're great supporters. They're also my fiercest critics, as you might imagine. They can point out every flaw I have, every mistake I make, like no one else can do, except maybe my daughters. That's family, right? In any case, we grew up in Wilmette, and then we sort of dispersed around the world. And I think one of the things that ended up happening is we are incredibly competitive with each other, even if we're fiercely loyal and always defend each other. And each of us went our own way. I ended up going to college in Massachusetts and medical school in Massachusetts and starting a family very young at the age of 24. Ram went into politics, staying at a bunch of cheap hotels while campaigning and raising money. And Ari initially went to Paris to live the good life on my dad's credit card, then came back to New York to learn the business of being an agent, and his agent, a legendary man who represented Elizabeth Taylor, Milos Forman, and a bunch of other stars, sent him to Los Angeles because he said that's where the future of agency is. And Ari, like everyone who starts out in the agency business, started out in the mailroom, worked his tail off, did not let anything stop him, and rose up. As we grew up, I think the last thing I'll end with is we all did something which I think is quite characteristic of families, but also very revealing about parents. As we grew up, my parents, like I think all parents, are conservative for their kids. They want them to succeed, and they're always worried about them. At my dad's 75th birthday, I got up and gave a toast to the following effect. You know, when I went to medical school, mostly because my parents wanted me to go, I was not very happy camper, you might say. I didn't like medical school. I thought there was too much memorization. I thought it was not very interesting. It wasn't really what I had set my heart on. And so I ended up making it my own by going into bioethics. I stopped medical school after 3 years, and I went to get a PhD. And my father, while I was doing this, was like, how could you go into bioethics? Who does bioethics? No one does bioethics. It's a crazy thing to do. This is the early 1980s, so he's not so far wrong. You know, just you're very good science. Stay in science and go do research, and you'll be a good faculty member at a medical school. I did bioethics, and proof's in the pudding. When Rahm got a call from Bill Clinton in late 1991 to join Clinton's campaign and be the chief fundraiser, my dad is like, Clinton, who ever heard of Clinton? Who's Bill Clinton? A governor of, what, Arkansas? What is going to happen? You're going to waste all your time. Fortunately, Rahm didn't listen either. When Ari was at ICM, a talent agency, he wanted to become a partner. He went into the CEO's office. He said, I want to be made a partner now. And the CEO said, no. Ari said, I'm going to leave then. And the man, all right. 2 in the morning, Ari decides, he and 3 other people, they're leaving. They're starting their own company. But my father's like, just be patient. You'll become a partner in time. Don't do anything rash. Fortunately, Ari didn't listen to him either. But I think it's natural for parents to be cautious. Fortunately, as I said, we didn't listen to our parents. We did what was high risk or what looked like high risk at the time. And I think that's very characteristic of exactly the way our parents would want us. And I think, thankfully, we've all, through mostly hard work that they instilled on us, high energy, succeeded. And the book tells you many more stories about how that happened. Thank you, and I think we have time for questions and answers. So, we have a question right there. Maybe you can stand up, tell us who you are. You'll have to embarrass yourself, too.
Okay. I'm just asking about, there seemed to be another child in the picture.
Yeah.
What's that?
Well, if you read the book, by one way of thinking, there are many, many children in the book. There's always seemed to be an extra mouth at the table. So early on, my parents had a friend from the hospital where my dad worked, from Mount Sinai, this resident and his wife were having difficulties, and this infant Boaz shows up at the house, and we're taking care of Boaz for a number of weeks. Starts a pattern. Later, when we're, I think I'm about 7 or 8, my parents have a friend, they both have some mental illness issues, and they are not doing well taking care of their son. And Jeffrey Wacker ends up in our house for a year. And in the bedroom of the three boys, we add another bed. And he goes to school and stays with us for the better part of a whole school year. And all through my childhood, various people live in the house, whether it's cousins like Jack Skin, who traveled the world, contracted hepatitis A, and is recuperating in our house for a year. Or it's Teddy, my dear cousin, who is, you know, not getting along with his parents and comes to stay with Auntie Marsh at her house. Or it's Ralph Felstein, who, you know, comes to our house and helps teach us how to do carpentry and helps us build a whole console in the family room for the TV and the stereo and all the books, which, by the way, 40 years later is still working fine in the basement. So there's always an added mouth. And then in 1973, my parents go ahead and adopt a little girl. By that time, I'm 16. Ram is 14. And Shoshana comes into our family. So, but she's a whole generation behind us, boys. We didn't grow up with her, as it were. Yeah.
Hi. Are your parents still alive?
Yeah, both of them are still alive and live on the North Shore in Chicago. Yeah, I'm going to see them on Thursday night.
Must be very proud of you. And your brothers.
Well, they knew. I'm not so sure that they thought, as I mentioned, they thought we succeeded so well. So, you know. What's bioethics, they keep asking me.
Hi. I think my wife and kids would like me to ask you this. So,
okay.
I had the opportunity to know you and to have read your book when you were quite a bit younger, and you kind of come off a little bit in the book as perhaps arrogant, obnoxious, self-absorbed.
Really?
Yeah. And
that's shocking.
And I'll say, and I've on occasion been accused of some of those characteristics myself. So I was just wondering, and from reading the book and hearing you, you've obviously changed quite a bit into someone who is, you know, knows himself very well and is very sympathetic and understands, you know, shows remarkable insight. I was curious whether you could describe that journey a little bit and how you made that transformation.
I can fake it really well. What can I say? First of all, I think the book, you know, if it does anything, pokes fun at the fact that we have flaws. We were all pretty flawed characters. I think I poke fun at myself. I hope I don't come across as praising that arrogance or haughtiness. I mean, I think, first of all, we came from a family that was internally fiercely competitive. One of the things that, you know, we took political discourse and cultural discourse and every other kind of discourse seriously. If you thought someone was worth it, you actually engaged in discussion and argument, more accurately, with them. If you thought they weren't worth it, you talked about the weather with them. You basically walked away and ignored them. And so the highest form of appreciation we could give as a family was a lot of argument. And so I think for many people, that sometimes came off as arrogant, sometimes came off as being combative, know-it-alls. But in fact, we were really showing our deepest respect for someone. We didn't realize that this wasn't how the rest of society behaved. Kind of a limitation in our growing up and being raised. I would say that one of the things I do mention in the book, if I had to criticize my parents on one element of their raising us, there are many I could do it on, but if I had to criticize them on one, we were very good, and my mom was actually very good, and again, I think one of the reasons the three brothers have stayed close over the years is we were very good at making up. She would not allow us to be angry or, at the end of a fight, stay angry at each other. She always made us, you know, well before this became popular, to hug it out, literally to hug it out. We had to hug each other. Now, that was very good, and we obviously ended up quite close, but it also truncated any, despite the fact we were a very verbal family, any articulation of emotional feelings. I would say we were emotionally quite superficial. So it took a lot of work. So as I relate in the book, there are probably four people who are integral to my growth in emotional intelligence. Five, I would say, actually. The first one was two guys from college. A good friend of mine, Greg Keating, who was probably my closest friend out of college, and when he went to Harvard Law School and I was at Harvard Medical School, he lived in my building for a year and then very close by. And he would always say, you know, you have to quiet it down. You can't take on every issue in the world and point out to me things I should just let go. Andy Oram, who was actually this very big 250-pound guy from, remind me actually physically a lot from of my grandfather, from a small town in upstate New York, Jamestown. He loved to argue. He was a debater, but he also recognized I used to irritate people to no end. And in several cross-country road trips, when we would drive from Amherst to my house in Chicago, we had very long discussions where he would help me be self-reflective. My wife, now ex-wife, was British, and just her presence, learning how to see the world through her eyes, of course, helped. I would say probably of all the things that helped, and then there's, I shouldn't forget, one of my students. So one of my cures for hating Harvard Medical School is that during my second year in medical school, I started teaching at Harvard College. And I started teaching. They have a very important major there called social studies, which is basically reading the classics from Thucydides and Plato and Aristotle all the way to Marx and Freud and Durkheim. It was a fantastic class. And I got the opportunity to teach in that class. And the first year I was running a seminar, and one of my students, probably the most brilliant college student I ever taught, named Adam Berger, who's now a lawyer in Seattle, one day was walking home with me, and he said, pointed out to me that, you know, I was intimidating students, and that my purpose in class was really to educate them and to make them see stuff and to take these ideas seriously, I had to ease up. And, you know, he was basically telling me, and I think he used this phrase, you're effing up in your goal. And it was very, you know, I still remember it today, so it had to be a very important moment in my life. But probably the most important people in my transformation and awareness, my three children. There is nothing to make you humble in the world like raising three children, and especially three girls who are hyper-articulate, emotionally sophisticated, and tell you all your flaws. It just makes it a lot easier. So, yeah. Question here, right there.
I heard you in a radio interview indicate that you took private ballet lessons, the three boys. So my question is, what, if anything, did you get out of that? And do you think your brother, Rom, who was interested, the most interested, may dance his way into the presidency?
So my mom was a dancer, and my parents actually are phenomenal dancers. They are the heart of any wedding or bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah celebration. They really are fantastic dancers. I think my mom had this idea that, you know, her kids should learn how to dance. We still can't figure out why she didn't sign us up for, like, ballroom dancing that might be useful in life or modern, but she signed us up for classical ballet. And there happened to be a dance studio at a mall not far from our house, about a mile from our house, above the Rexall Pharmacy. And it was actually a male instructor, and it wasn't private lessons that we took. It was just that there were only three people in the lesson, the Emmanuel brothers. So, yes, we had black tights. We had our black ballet shoes. We learned how to do, you know, first position, second position, up to fifth position. We had a lot of activity at the bar. Somehow after a year, Ari and I convinced our mom that this was not for us. We were not making any progress. I'm a horrendous dancer. I can't keep time. I learned, I'm pretty sure, nothing from it. Ram, on the other hand, was a good dancer. And I think if he had decided, I really want to do dance, this is my calling in life, my mom would have been really thrilled, terrifically thrilled. And but, you know, he did that and I think moved on to politics, which is his real calling in life. And, I mean, he's completely focused now. He loves his job. He loves running the city of Chicago, likes solving problems and making things better, and in particular, I think, wakes up every morning figuring out how can he do things better for children. We are all, one way or another, the son of our father, a pediatrician, and I think making the world better for our children in America is our real strong passion. So, yeah. Wait for the mic.
Yeah, whenever I read or hear about people like you, high-achieving people, obviously lots and lots on your plate. What did you sacrifice in order to find the time to write a book that's totally out of the stream of your activity, your work, and your family? I mean,
so let me begin by taking that question a little away from the heart of the question. The one thing which I hope the book makes pretty clear is that we are not, by any stretch of the imagination, we're not unusual kids. We were average kids. As a matter of fact, when we graduated from high school, I say this over and over, and it's 100% true, no one would have said, those Emmanuel boys, they're destined to succeed. You can just see it, you know, blah, blah, blah. Ari wasn't, he was a good athlete, but he wasn't a state champion in anything. Ram was sort of middling of his class. Wasn't the greatest actor or the greatest dancer in school. I was a very good student, graduated near the top of my class, but I wasn't number one, and I certainly wasn't some walking encyclopedia. There are many other kids in school, certainly just as smart as I was. So we didn't graduate with anyone taking any notice of us. One of the key things that I think does lead to our success, well, we have many, one of them I attribute to my father, which was early on, he taught us, he played chess with us, and he would always say, you know, like Napoleon, offense is the best defense. And I think all of us are constantly charging forward and never playing defense. Second, I think he gave us, more by genetics than anything else, the high energy that we have. People always ask, you know, do you sleep? Of course we sleep. And actually we sleep a normal amount. But we also, in the day, make better use of our time. We're constant motion. We're constantly sitting down. I have this little thing on me now that records every step I take. Let's just say it's well above average. I take a lot more steps than the normal person. And I think that's one thing which does characterize Ram, Ari, and I, is that we're full throttle all the hours that we're awake. I don't know that I sacrificed anything by doing this book. Yes, it came at the end of the day, came on weekends. I probably sacrificed, you know, some downtime, a few naps along the way. I certainly gained a lot from the book. I got an opportunity to tell stories for my kids that will be part of their legacy and my nephews and nieces. I got deeper understanding of my family, which I think I would not have thought more deeply about in the way I did had I not had the opportunity to write the book. And I also actually got stories that I never knew existed. And I got reminded of stories that I have long suppressed. So my father I don't think ever told us the story of his role in the 1948 War of Independence in Israel. He told us that he interrupted medical school to go back. But one of the things we learned as part of this book process was the fact that he was, in fact, on what passed for an armored vehicle in Israel at that time, a Jeep with a machine gun on it. He would feed the machine gun bullets and at times took the machine gun and did what he did. And he was in a group that encircled Gaza and went further south towards El Arish in Egypt, and their advance was stopped when the British dropped leaflets saying, if you advance anymore, we're going to bomb you, and they turned around quickly and went back to Israel. We didn't know that story, had no idea about that story. We got that story out of my father as part of this book. In addition, I had long suppressed one of the stories in the book is during my grade school years, there was a kid in my school. We had only one class per grade. We had about 22 students, and Spencer Waller was always the best student in class. Spencer always thwarted me. Spencer, you know, if we worked hard and I got an A on a project, Spencer got an A+. And I could never surpass Spencer. Well, he reminded me that once in kindergarten, I got frustrated with him, and I put my foot out and tripped him, and he bit through his tongue. It's not a mystery why I forgot that story. But one of the benefits you get out of writing a book is you get reminded about stories that you long suppressed. So I gained a lot, actually, out of writing this book. In the back, maybe we can get a question.
It has been said that Ari Gold and Entourage is based on your brother, Ari. Do you feel that way?
I'm at a deficit to answer that question. I don't own a TV. I've never seen the show. All I know is that Jeremy Piven plays him, and apparently lots of people think they know about Ari through Jeremy Piven. So I'll demur. So, okay.
Hi, my name is Deborah Commons. Thank you for coming today.
My privilege.
I'm a fan of your brother, Ram.
Oh, good.
And I've enjoyed the stories about him especially. I saw him interviewed several times when he became mayor of Chicago. I was very impressed with his plans and what he was doing. And from what I read, he's had, you know, pretty tough time being the mayor of Chicago. So my question is, and you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, does he ever come to you for input or for advice?
He's not that stupid. Let's just say we talk frequently. He came to me, I provided a lot more advice when he was chief of staff and I was working on the healthcare reform, and I was working on healthcare reform, on global health, and perforce in my area of expertise. We had a lot of exchange, and I did a lot of work at his request and generate ideas at his request. Ram is very good about giving me advice, however. Question back there? Wait for the microphone so everyone can hear. It's coming up.
Oh. Okay. Can you tell us about your three daughters?
No. If you look at the back of the book, there's a little genealogy and there are no names. And I think they're their own people, and they're doing their own things. I can just tell you they're incredibly successful, and I'm an incredibly proud dad of them.
Do you get together with your parents and brothers for Seder's, Thanksgiving, et cetera, et cetera? How does that?
The answer to that question is yes and no. So sometime in the early 90s, as I mentioned in the book, Ram, who had by this time worked in the Clinton administration, decided that it was time for us to all get together every Thanksgiving. We had more or less spent the 80s, each of us doing different things. I started medical school and began a family early on. Ram was working in politics and rising, and Ari was rising in the talent. And we were all sort of preoccupied with what we were doing. And they didn't have families. But then about, as I said, the early 1990s, Ram decided enough was enough and instituted by force, and this will surprise you, by force of personality, instituted that we were going to all get together for Thanksgiving, hell or high water. We were going to rotate among the three brothers' houses, so each year it would go to someone else's house with responsibility for organizing activities and cooking the meal. And we've done that every year since, very faithfully. This last year, it was in my house in Washington, and everyone flew in. My parents come, my brothers came, my sister's children came, and that is a very important, pretty sacrosanct activity. We don't actually all do seders together, and that has not come to pass. So in the... Sorry.
You mentioned your mother's involvement in the civil rights movement, and I'm wondering if she was also active in the women's movement and whether she had career aspirations, educational aspirations for herself that she wasn't able to accomplish in part because of being a woman.
Well, it's hard to know what... she certainly didn't go to college because, as I relate in the story, she saved up her own money to go to college. But my grandfather forced her to give it to the son who was younger. And so my mom never went to college. She ended up becoming a radiation technician. And again, that's how she met my father. Certainly... after she got married and pregnant and had me, she viewed being a mom as her number one, two, and three job, and certainly we occupied full time of her hours in the day. She was, as I said, very active in the civil rights movement. She was not active in the women's movement. She just lived her activity. But she was definitely thinking about a role in politics, in Chicago politics, so that when we were all safely ensconced in school, she had the day free, she could do that. And then, as I mentioned, in 1968, my father upped and moved us to the suburbs, and that activity got truncated. My mom is, if nothing, innovative and creative, and so she became much more active in the anti-war movement, maintained some of her activity, as I mentioned, in the civil rights movement, And that's how she did things. She, in the end, never ran for political office, and I think that probably was to her frustration. I am sure that if she were born today, she'd have a very, very different career trajectory. She is a big personality, as the book makes clear. She's forceful in her own way, and she is very, very determined, and I think easily would have succeeded today in a very, very different way than what ended up being her life. But that's, you know, of course, we're all made by the circumstance and the moment in time when we are raised. As I make clear in the book, had we been born probably 10 or 20 years before, there's no chance you would have ever heard of the Emanuel Brothers. And if we had been born 10 or 20 years later, there's probably also no chance you would have heard about the Emanuel Brothers. There's a question in the back there.
First of all, you and I share Sandy Schwartz as a friend, so we're both very lucky in that.
Yeah.
Here's my question. Of the many things that you've done, I'm interested in what you're proudest of, maybe besides your children.
Besides my children.
Besides.
Yeah. Well, I'm clear. Undoubtedly, I'm most proud of my children. It's been the biggest success, and I actually started my PhD in part to have a completely flexible schedule to begin raising my eldest. So probably the thing I'm most proud of is my work in getting the Affordable Care Act passed. It's a world history. It's a world historical event. As I tell my students at the University of Pennsylvania, and I tell the world, actually, on one of these massive online courses where I have a course on health policy and the Affordable Care Act, you know, I say we've been trying in America to get health care reform for 100 years. Actually, Teddy Roosevelt began the effort. It took 100 years, almost to the year, to get it passed. President Obama shepherded it through with help from Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid. How could I blank on it? I just met him 10 days ago. Harry Reid and all the rest of the members of Congress. As I've often said, it's not a perfect bill, but it certainly is a dramatic improvement and will make the country's healthcare system much, much better. I'm really proud of that work. I'm also really proud of all I've done to make bioethics a rigorous discipline, to establish it as a firm area within American medical education and American medical care, and in the particular areas where I've been able to contribute, whether it's trying to get end-of-life care to be better in this country or to improve the ethics around conducting research trials. I think, you know, I'm happy with my contributions. I think I've had a very, very wonderful life. I know that my parents forced me to go to medical school, and it wasn't the main thing I wanted to do, although I didn't have an alternative. It's worked out fantastically well for me. One more question, right here.
Thank you. You've been really interesting to listen to.
Thank you very much.
I was wondering what was your motivation for writing the book and what you hope that readers will get from reading the book.
There are really two streams that sort of come together and came together at the right moment in time. One is I began jotting down notes about stories, vignettes, things I wanted to remember to pass on to my children. And some of them were just lines that I knew what the vignette was. Some of them I actually wrote out the vignettes, and I began thinking, well, I'll buy a video camera, and maybe once a week I'll record a story or record a few stories for my kids. And then another set of events happened is that we as brothers began getting the persistent question, which, as I put in the book, for me was most memorable from Maureen Dowd, which is, you know, what did Mom put in the cereal? So I like to blame Maureen Dowd for the book. You know, she kept asking at the 2009 inauguration of President Obama, I got to meet your parents. I kept asking, Maureen, why do you have to meet my parents? I got to find out what Mom put in the cereal. And then when my brother was elected and took office in Chicago, she was there, and we were talking because she wanted to clarify some things for a column, and she says, I got to meet your mom at the party. I got to meet your mom. And I said, why, Maureen? She says, I got to find out what Mom put in the cereal. So the book is an answer to what did Mom put in the cereal, but it's also an answer to a particular moment of American history. I think a pretty classic experience of people who are immigrants, the sons of immigrants growing up in the United States, the change that has happened in the United States, the great opportunities that people can realize in the United States despite prejudice and many other things that are here. And, you know, really our family, my brothers and I, could not be successful, I'm pretty sure, in any other country, and certainly not to the degree that we have been privileged to be successful in the United States. Thank you very much. It's been a real treat.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.